Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Yes, you found the spot. Yes, this is heritageradionetwork.org, and I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Here with you on the 12th of August, 2012. Excuse me while I reach over and turn up my phone so I can hear. Much better. This is Burning Down the House, and this is your weekly fix of everything and anything related to the built environment. And I would like to follow up on our conversation of last week with Elizabeth Heider, who's the chair of the Executive Committee of the United States Green Building Council, also known as the USGBC. And this episode may be more of interest to you, my brothers and sisters, who are architects and who are intern architects or internationally practicing, than the even the most informed lay listener or civilian, as I like to call you, good friends, because it involves some of the core arguments that are happening within our profession. You might say that I feel that my role as your host here on Heritage Radio Network is to be a syncretist. Now, before you all rush off to look that up, syncretism means the attempt to reconcile opposing opinions or beliefs, mostly beliefs, or systems of belief, into one unified theory. Certainly, this has been the goal of modern physics, to move from a unified field theory to string theory, which presently is believed to possibly pull together all of the different aspects of traditional and advanced physics. In terms of architecture, there's not a neologism for that yet. But if you wish to call me a syncretist, I'm happy to take the label. There are, speaking of the USGBC, there are some detractors. And I'm thinking at the moment of the friend of this program, architect Duo Dickinson, who suggests that sustainable architecture and the good green movement are a new sort of religion. He's even gone so far as to call the USGBC architecture's new Scientology. I've known a few Scientologists, and I've known a lot of Episcopalians, Duo, and I count among my friends many Jews and a few Muslims, and people of no particular belief whatsoever, and a few militant atheists. And so I have a little bit of exposure to religion. But to suppose that the LEED system, the LEED system of the USGBC, is a religion or a form of political expression seems to come up again and again. And some, including, I think, our friend Duo, would call this movement greenwashing, apropos of, say, as compared with brainwashing or whitewashing. Brainwashing as in behavior modification and extreme indoctrination, and whitewashing as in covering over the true condition of things. Say, those of you who are American and have read Mark Twain, Tom Sawyer's Aunt Polly's wooden fence that needed whitewashing with an even coat of white. Well, certainly political, because the Green Movement in general necessarily involves issues of national policy as pertains to the use of natural resources. I disagree on the categorization that being green is as being religious, because religion involves issues of faith which cannot be based on science, but rather are based on belief. And because they're not scientific, it's unfounded belief. Now, there are aspects of the new Good Green movement which are scientific and which are worthy of investigation. So in no particular order, I want to talk about a few different aspects of our current green world. Are they greenwashing? True or not? One of those aspects is this thing called embodied energy. The amount of energy it took to create a building component and put it into a building. And then there's another aspect of this, which is the amount of carbon dioxide that's been captured, usually by a biological material. Another aspect of the landscape is conformance with energy conservation codes, such as ASHRAE, the American Society of Heating, Refrigerating, and Air Conditioning Engineers, the ASHRAE Standard 90.1, and especially ASHRAE 90.1 Appendix G, which has been adopted by every United States jurisdiction as the standard by which buildings shall be allowed to be built or not, depending on their energy conservation. Then I want to talk a little bit about some of the attitudes that seem to be indicative of the people who take one or another point of view about whether energy is important or whether form is important or whether it's all important or whether none of it is important, but what is really important is how that it serves the people who are using the structure. Or is it not important that it serve people at all, but rather just be simply beautiful? Let's take a little break, some Prokofiev music. Burning Down the House, I'm Curtis B. Wayne, talking about greenwashing, a label that's applied to some of the movements of the good green world. And I was talking about, or I threw out as a topic, the political aspect of the green movement, national policy, how we use our natural resources. Well, this is not a new thing. a little more than 100 years ago, everybody's favorite president, American President Teddy Roosevelt, insisted upon and Congress created our first national parks. Conservation became an issue of national policy. Without TR, as we like to call him, Theodore Roosevelt, there would have been no Park Service. There would not have been national forests. And so the argument over the use of the national lands and the timber that is in the national forests goes back to the national policy decision to preserve those lands and the timber that are in them. Now, if we look at the notion of capturing carbon, well, trees are very important because they take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. And then if you log those trees, that is, if you timber them, if you cut them down, take them away, and plant new trees, then there are new biological organisms to capture even more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And if we're worried about global warming, then we have to be worried about the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, because carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. And what that means is that it turns our atmosphere into a greenhouse-like, that is to say, a heat-trapping mechanism. Even though it's not a machine, it acts mechanistically, the same as a sheet of glass in a greenhouse enclosure traps solar heat. And that is not new news to any of you, my colleagues in the profession, but to some of you who are interested lay people who are still with us, you might want to look into that a little bit, especially if you are younger listeners. Greenhouse gases, or GHGs, are very important and hotly debated, although I think increasingly less. They certainly have been hotly debated topic in the ongoing discussion of climate change. I think that nobody can disagree that the climate is changing. The reason for climate change is one that I don't want to get into right now, because I don't see the science there to irrefutably prove that it is man-made and not simply a combination of many, many, many factors, one of which is the period of great solar activity with solar flares that we're experiencing right now. But going back to national policy, if Congress can legislate appropriation of lands, and they have, and if cities can legislate compliance for city-owned buildings and developed buildings, and the government also, the federal government, can legislate that new construction must comply with the requirements of LEED, then we've established that regulatory authorities can legislate conservation measures, which means that they could eventually legislate measures to curtail the demolition of existing structures, because those existing structures contain or are repositories of embodied energy, which we'll get into a little bit later. Now, one thing that the that every regulatory authority has instituted is conformance with the ASHRAE standards for energy efficiency, ASHRAE 90.1. And one of the good things, O ye detractors of USGBC, hearken to this, that in order to have a LEED certification, a LEED certified building must perform better than the baseline set forth by ASHRAE 90.1. Therefore, just prima facie, on the face of it, a LEED building is going to be a good building because it is going to be a better energy conserving structure. So say what you like about LEED being this movement that somehow we might imagine, sweeps aside the need for architects, because now we have people who are lead APs, and we have spoken about that. Yes, you could be a lead AP and be a high school dropout. It doesn't really mean that you're a professional, even though AP means accredited professional. Let us set aside the semantics of that. To do better than the ASHRAE standard is a good thing. Or is that a religious belief, to believe that saving energy is a good thing? Is it a scientifically good thing? Well, to the extent that most of our energy in this world comes from the combustion of fossil fuels, those ancient, you know, plankton and dinosaurs and all that stuff that over millions and millions of years was compressed in sediment and turned into what we know as oil, which in the beginning was known as rock oil, oil that came out of rocks instead of oil that came out of plant oil or spermaceti whale oil. There were many different oils. I mean, there was oil and wool and all sorts of oily things. And then, of course, there was always beeswax. But rock oil, petroleum, which means rock oil, actually, petrus, meaning rock, oleum, oil, petroleum, hydrocarbons from the earth. When they're combusted, then they go up into the atmosphere as CO2. So that conserving energy presently, when most of our energy comes from petroleum and ends up as CO2 in the atmosphere, can be seen to be scientifically a good thing to have less of it around. Now, as a syncretist, I have to also consider who are the people who are holding out on all of these different points of view. And let's have a little bit of political music while I frame my thoughts.
White Oak Pastures is a 146-year-old multi-generational family farm that works in cooperation with nature to produce artisan meat that is safe, healthy, nutritious, and good to eat. Without fail, we ensure that our production practices are economically practical, ecologically sustainable, and that the animals are always humanely treated. We never falter in our determination to conduct our business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Yes, everything in life these days is political. The decision of what sort of food you're going to eat can be seen as a political act. That was, of course, Cream Live some time back in the middle of the 20th century. I see the world of architecture and technique and the just a profession in general in terms of different camps. We have, to make things really simple, in my cosmography, the academics, the practitioners, and the technicians. Let me define my terms. The academics, who in my opinion, these are my opinions and not those of the heritageradionetwork.org, let me make that stipulation, are the high-handed crew who crave upper crust applause and encomiums, but haven't the wit, nor dare I say the education, to merit anything beyond indifference. This is the crew that loves to use the word intervention, a word that might mean a thing or act as onerous, a social engineering campaign as what Robert Moses did in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s in New York City, urban slum clearance, or intervention might be as innocuous and piffling as occupying a vacant lot with a rubbishy sort of temporary stagecraft, such as last summer's dreary BMW Guggenheim lab, so-called lab, that was down on Houston Street. Then we have the practitioners, the self-acclaimed populists with equally highbrow aspirations, but who cling to received notions of, let's put quotes around this, correct form under the catch-all label of tradition. And you know who I'm talking about. Then there are, there's a little subgroup to the practitioners, the so-called classicists. There is a strain of funny stuff going around where people only design buildings in a form that would have been considered eclectic at the beginning of the 20th century, but that is entirely following the rule books of Vignola, which are derivative of Vitruvius as interpreted by Palladio. You guys and girls who do that kind of stuff, you know what I'm talking about. But you've lost all currency, and I'm afraid you merit no more than a footnote. And then there are the technicians, who would like to be able to demonstrate the validity of anything that we do in terms of how it makes the number one pressing issue of preserving the human race better, which is the environment. This isn't a new thing. Anyone who's over the age of 40 probably knows about Bucky Fuller. And those of us over the age of 50 probably knows about the Whole Earth Catalog of Stuart Brand in the late 1960s and early 1970s, which was a sort of a Sears Roebuck catalog. Wow, there's an anachronism. Once upon a time, Sears actually published a catalog, and they sent it all over the land for probably almost 100 years. They were the original catalog sellers. No more. But the Whole Earth Catalog was a sort of a Sears Roebuck catalog of everything that you could do to get off the grid, inspired by the notion put forward by Bucky Fuller that this planet is really a spaceship, and we are traveling through the cosmos, and this is spaceship Earth. The air that we have on our spaceship is all the air that we're ever going to have. The water, all 98 natural elements, and all the other couple dozen of the transitory unstable elements, you know, like americium and newtonium and all those unstable isotopes that do funky things when you squeeze them together and cause all sorts of fission things. Anyway, all of what we've got is right here on our spaceship Earth. And so then that sort of appeals to those of us who are technicians, and we'd like to be able to approach what we do in terms of the built landscape from a scientific point of view. So those of you who are our younger colleagues who are thinking, well, I've got this architecture degree, what can I do with it? Let me direct your attention to the notion of embodied energy, and let me reveal a little bit of bunkum about some of the green notions that have become received notions of ordinary life. Let's talk about recycling for a moment. There are many, many different kinds of plastics. Plastics, by and large, come from petroleum. There are some plastics that come from organic materials that haven't been laying in the earth for millions of years, but those have problems with decomposition. So let's set those aside for a while. Most plastics come from petroleum, and if we continue to use petroleum for making disposable things instead of using durable things that require washing in order to be used again, well, then we're going to run out of petroleum sooner than we would have liked, and this might be a crisis. It might be a crisis soon. It might be a crisis in our grandchildren's time, our great-grandchildren's time, or our great-great-grandchildren's time. But since no one has produced this elusive thing of cold fusion or even fusion power, thermoelectric power, you know, like H-bombs versus A-bombs. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you need to do a little 20th century reading up. First, there was the atomic reaction, and then there was the thermonuclear reaction, which is fusion, fission to fusion. And, well, no one solved that in terms of being able to make electricity, so we don't have fusion power. And yes, maybe in 150 years, we'll power our cars just like Dr. Brown's flying DeLorean in Back to the Future with household garbage. It's possible. I doubt it, but it's possible. So if you're looking for a career in the green movement, you might look at the fact that most of the recyclable bottles and and materials that go into the waste stream as, quote, recyclable are not presently recyclable. Municipalities don't have the they don't have the resources to sort out the 8 or 9 different kinds of plastic and divert them to recyclers. Now, if you are a really clever sort of engineering and robotics kind of person, you might be able to invent a device that would grab a Nalgene bottle and spin it around in all 6 axes and capture an image and say, oh, this is a type 6 recyclable plastic, and pitch it over there in the bin. Well, nobody's done that yet. If you know the Brazilian filmmaker Vic Muniz. Vic Muniz. He's got a wonderful movie about the garbage pickers in Rio. People live in the garbage dump, and these garbage pickers are expert at ferreting out the different kinds of plastic. Well, that's human intelligence. We don't have garbage pickers, for better or worse, in North America. And I understand that they've closed the big dump in Rio. There's a possibility for something in the future. Because plastic has embodied energy, and because plastic can be recycled and reused into a more durable product than a disposable Coke bottle. That's just one possibility for where the good green movement might go. One of the other aspects of the study of embodied energy, if we look at a building, we know that it took so many BTUs or kilowatts, and they are convertible to each other, of energy to, for example, make a pound of steel. Once that pound of steel is installed in a building, there's a certain amount of energy that has been invested in that building, and to just then simply tear down the building, expending more energy, and putting it in a landfill where it does nothing for society, is a waste of the heritage of previous societies. Now, if we look at the world in terms of a Bucky Fuller point of view, it's Bucky who said that in the future we'll be mining the garbage dumps because there are natural resources there that spaceship Earth will need. We have to really give that serious consideration. Now, presently, the LEED system doesn't really get into embodied energy studies. But without the USGBC and without the LEED system, there was no way to codify any of this discussion in terms of checklists. And checklists are very important as a way of focusing people's attention. Let's take a little couple minutes of Kepler and come back and talk about things that we can do that we can all agree upon. Curtis B. Wayne, Burning Down the House. It was a little bit from Phil Glass's opera, Kepler. An on-tract passage speaking to crafting a new world view. I think all of you different factions out there are Platonists. You have conflicting Platonic views, and you need to get beyond that and have a syncretic view and start agreeing on good practice. To paraphrase Christopher Hitchens, who questioned whether, in fact, he had a profession as a writer, he asks of himself, do we have a profession, or rather, do we have a craft and practice? Okay, so as architects, if we have a profession, then we profess a faith. Do we not? If we have a craft, then we proclaim a standard of craftsmanship. If architecture is both an art and a craft, then as artists, we appeal to the muses to give us inspiration, and we proclaim a standard of craft. If we're a profession, then we are a faith-based enterprise. So what faith would we have? We could have a faith in science. We could have a faith in our own egos. We could have a faith in art, but then that's a faith in appealing to the muses. Or do we have a craft and a practice? The practitioners would say, well, I don't want to have to submit my work to a scientific inquiry. And I think that is at root of the reticence to the imposition of the LEED system by the federal government and Chicago and New York for their own buildings, that the buildings, the new buildings and the new development has to conform to the LEED system. You practitioners don't want to have to submit to any sort of scientific inquiry. Well, here's the thing. We architects designed buildings that were energy hogs. We designed the wonderful post-war California-inspired ranch house with its breezeways and big, big sections of glass that were energy hogs. And when the energy crisis of the early 1970s happened, what did we do? Not much. My first job in 1972, we didn't even necessarily put insulation in tract houses. It was nice, but hey, it added a little bit of expense. Hey, what's the problem? We didn't even think about energy. Now it's mandated that we pay attention because of energy construction conservation codes. So let us all start talking to each other a little bit more. You academics, put your highfalutin ego into putting a theoretical construct behind why it is professional to use resources in the most efficient way, looking at capturing of carbon and conserving energy going forward, and in terms of durability. Those of you over there on the traditional side, let us give some thought to traditional materials that are durable. And let us all, practitioners, traditionalists, scientific technicians, and academics, let us all therefore agree that if we don't pull together and come up with a syncretic standard of our craft, it is quite likely that sooner or later the politicians will decide for us. And there is a very strong argument that no building that could, under any circumstance, be repurposed for any other use should never be demolished because of the enormous amount of embodied energy in that structure. Now, I've recently been looking into a study in support or confirmation of a movement here in New York City put forward by the City Planning Commission, suggesting that certain parts of Midtown that have aging office buildings, say from the post-war period, could economically be demolished and replaced by buildings of even greater density. Currently, the zoning in many parts of the commercial district of Midtown have an FAR, a floor area ratio of 15, which means that you're looking at a 22-story building, because the building's not going to be occupying the entire footprint of the site. owing to required setbacks and so forth. So the city planning is suggesting that FAR be increased to over 20, which means that you might be in a position of taking down a 30-story building and replacing it with a 40-story building. But when you look at the embodied energy aspects of that transaction, and you look at the huge, huge embodied energy of a 30-story building, as best we can determine it, you see that even with the most LEED platinum or beyond new structure, given the technology that we have right now, before you break even in terms of a much reduced energy consumption in a new structure compared with an old energy hog building that's perhaps 45 years old, the payback is quite long. Unless then you take into consideration the improved productivity of people who would work in an office building if they have more access to daylight and if they have some visual access to living, growing things, you know, vegetative roofs, a view to a park, a sky garden, aspects like that. These issues cut across all lines of aesthetic, formalistic, traditional, or technical predispositions. These are the issues that we'll be facing in the next 25 to 30 years. Do we, as a profession, as a group, as a cohort of those who are informing and directing the creation and recreation and rejuvenation of our built landscape, do we come together to agree on basic principles of design and construction? I think that we must. I welcome your responses. You can always reach me through Heritage Radio Network info@heritageradionetwork.org. Don't think that I'm losing my religion. I keep the faith. Thank you for listening. You keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.